A special message before we get today's show off and rolling. Welcome to the world, Emmett Carroll Coatney, born at 2:34 on the last day of November in 2020, weighing 7 pounds, 12 ounces. Mom, Nancy, and baby are happy. Drew, hanging in there as well, it sounds like, though he's less important than those other two. But welcome to the world. My favorite thing about this gig is getting to do messages like this. Emmett Carroll Coatney, can't wait to meet you. Hello and welcome to the In the Money Players Podcast. This is our show for Tuesday, December 1st, Giving Tuesday. The pub date also of a book we're going to be talking about in a little bit. Definitely a departure today, something very different. Listen, let me apologize in advance. Most of this show was recorded on a microphone I'm not used to using, and it doesn't sound very good. Won't be using it again. So my audio for the rest of this show, not up to snuff. I corrected it for the intro and outro. Doesn't do you guys all that much good. But anyway, hopefully it won't make you crazy. The show today, we've got Andrew Cotter, a fantastic sports broadcaster, gained viral video fame during the pandemic. We have a fun chat. There's some horse racing chatter mixed in, but it's mainly about his experience during the pandemic and this amazing work he's done. I think it's going to be of great interest to the vast majority of In the Money fans, and I'm really looking forward to your hearing that. And then this is Tuesday, December 1st, as I mentioned. That's also Giving Tuesday. You know who we're going to have on for Giving Tuesday. That's Kim Weir of the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation to talk about everything going on there. So the next thing you're going to hear is an audio clip of one of the viral videos Andrew Cotter put together. And then we'll get right to that interview post-haste.
Well, how fitting that it should come down to these two. Olive in her familiar black, five times the champion. Mabel, the rising star, winner last year. You can see how excited they are, but also feel the tension.
Get on with it.
And here it's in the crowd as we near the start of this final. And now they go, Olive away first, but a problem with Mabel's ball. That might cost her now, having to play catch-up. Both settling quickly into rhythm. You can see the contrast in styles. Mabel, heavy tail use, happy to be alive. Everything's amazing. Olive, more steady, wasting little energy. Very much of the old Labrador school. Eating's a serious business. Don't bollocks around wagging your tail.
A little bit of a departure on the show today, but this is an interview I have been wanting to do for the last couple of months. Everybody has voices that helped them through this incredibly difficult 2020. And the next voice you're about to hear is one of those for me. He became a social media sensation on the back of a very successful broadcasting career. And now he's got a book. It's called Olive, Mabel, and Me, Life and Adventures with Two Very Good Dogs. Welcome to the In the Money Airwaves, Andrew Cotter. Andrew, how are you today?
I'm fine. I feel I should deliver with my voice on that, on the very first sentence after that amazing introduction. But I've actually had a bit of a cold. And, you know, we used to think of a cold as the end of the world. And now, obviously, it's not. But you stress to people when you sound a bit throaty, whether it's just a cold. I promise it's just a cold. I've got to go through tests at the moment every week because I'm doing some rugby commentary. Imagine that. I'm doing some actual sports commentary. But every week, weekend, I'm doing some rugby commentary at the moment on internationals, and the company, it's Prime Video, it's Amazon, and they insist that you have a COVID-19 test on the Tuesday. So I'm passing them all with flying colours. So, I stress again, it's just a cold.
Good to know. We're not worried about you, yeah. At least not on that level, no. Which is good. I want to start because this is, in theory, a horse racing show. You know, we go on our tangents now and again. But as somebody who works in the world of sports broadcasting, have you ever done anything in the realm of horse racing, and how important is it to your life? Obviously, it holds a bit more of a place in the culture in your part of the world than it does over here in the United States. So I'm assuming you'll have some answer to this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I know of racing and the importance of it to the British sporting public, and particular things like the Cheltenham Festival, which always is taking place in the middle of the Six Nations rugby tournament, which I cover, and suddenly attention gets taken away from the Six Nations, and, you know, it's all about 150,000 people flocking to the southwest of England. But, you know, every big racing meeting you take notice of, whether it's the Derby or whether it's Aintree, you know, for the Grand National, whatever it might be, you know, Royal Ascot, it's these are events like the big sporting events in the UK. They are sort of mileposts in the year for people in terms of, you know, they recognize them as more than sporting events. They're social events. They are events that are sort of part of the fabric of society. So all the big events, all the big meetings in racing, I'm very much aware of. But I must confess, I'm not a massive racing fan, which this is probably where you hang up on me here. but listen, I know plenty of people in racing. This sounds like terrible name dropping. It's not supposed to be at all. But every year at the Masters, I go with a guy, Rishi Persad, who you know very well, who works in racing broadcasting. Fantastic bloke over here. We go and meet up with JP McManus because he's a big golf fan with Dermot Desmond. They go over there to the Masters, and we meet up and with quite a few other people. AP McCoy's there, so that's when I get most of my racing knowledge, chatting to those people and trying not to appear too ignorant. So I try and ask gentle questions like, so the front of the horse is the nose, yes, and the back end is so it's tricky, but again, racing is not necessarily one of the sports. When I watch the commentators on racing as well, I think, and they might watch the sports I do and think, oh, that'd be a hard sport to commentate on, you know, commentating on rugby or athletics or whatever it might be, so track and field. But when I watch the great racing commentators, and for years on television over in the UK it was Peter O'Sullivan, but there's a radio commentator over here, John Hunt, who does it for BBC Radio, and he is brilliant. He's brilliant. And I mean, my comparison would be when I do athletics, track and field as they call it in North America, in that, you know, you've got to reach that peak, that crescendo, just as the athletes or the horses go across the line, and you've got to get this identification. You've got to get the winner right, and you've got to get the sequence of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever it might be. But and it's remembering all the names and all the silks and all the jockeys and all the, you know, when you're doing it in athletics, you remember looking at all the colours of the vests and the different stride patterns and the faces, obviously. But it's I really, really admire what they do in racing, because it seems to happen at just 100 miles an hour.
It's so fast, and there so many of them, especially in your part of the world, are so, so good. I had the pleasure of working with John Hunt, actually early days of the pandemic, when they had all the muckety-mucks like him in the mix too, covering American racing, when American racing was some of the only sport going on in the world. And we did an afternoon at Gulfstream Park. I think I went 0-9. I'm guessing John doesn't think I'm much of a good judge, but he was such a professional that he raised the level of the broadcast anyway. Have you ever had any temptation to attempt to commentate on a race?
No, because although I would quite like to do it from the sort of challenge or the dynamic of doing it, for all those reasons I've just talked about, in terms of the identification, in terms of the slow build as they go from furlong, and then you're getting closer and closer to the winning post. And it is, and again, I do it in athletics, and you know, in the Olympics, the World Championships or whatever, when they're going around the track, and it's a build, and you're adding little bits of information, it's a slow, and it's just, you can, if you looked at the sound graph, you know, on a computer, and looked at the sound graph for the commentary, and you just see it slowly swelling, growing all the way closer to the line, and then it's just that explosion, and it is like a sort of, you know, this climactic thing, and then it sort of ebbs away once they've come across the winning line. And It's the timing of it. It's the cadence. It's the rhythm. It's the sound. It's the phrases. So it is, you know, a beautiful thing to listen to. Whether you're a massive racing fan or not, you can listen to someone like John Hunt and go, that is beautiful sports commentary. And that's why sports commentary done at its very best adds so much to a broadcast. I'm not talking about radio, which that's where we hear John Hunt, you know, most of all over here. But even on television, you know, you can watch, of course you can watch a sporting event without commentary. And a bad commentary will really ruin the experience. But a good commentary will add just that extra bit, the icing on the cake. It is just the thing that complements the pictures that you are seeing and adds to your enjoyment of it. And that's what the sort of great commentators do.
As you were talking, I think most of the listeners were probably picturing Tom Durkin, the legendary race caller who called many Breeders' Cups. So you may have even heard some of his calls over the years. What you were describing is exactly that. It's like filling in the blanks and that added color that just makes the whole picture.
When did he stop doing it then?
Durkin probably stopped doing the Breeders' Cup about 10 years ago and probably retired about, gosh, he was doing Saratoga, I think, up until, 5 or 6 years ago.
See, I do remember seeing the Breeders' Cup when Rock of Gibraltar, which was, you know, obviously, you know, owned, park owned by Alex Ferguson. And I just remember a commentator saying, "Here comes the Rock!" And it was just, it just sounded great. It was just fantastic.
That sounds like Durkin.
Yeah.
That definitely sounds like Durkin. I've got to ask you some Scottish questions because, you know, it's just a personal fascination. And one of my favorite places in the world is Scotland. It plays a major role in the book. I swear we'll talk about the book at some point. My family, we had one of our most fun days out and fun days at the races at Perth Racecourse.
Right.
I remember they had a special program for kids. An old Scottish man randomly offered my young daughter a pound to bet with. And it just, there was something about the sporting culture in Scotland. It's just my observation, but it just seemed even more friendly and inclusive and part of just normal everyday life than anywhere I've been in the world. Would you say that's accurate?
I think very possibly. I think it's because it's so dark and miserable in Scotland. And I say that as a Scot, I'm allowed to say that, in that we need to take our entertainment where we can get it. Because, my God, especially at the moment, I mean, it's dark at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It doesn't get light until 9:30 or whatever. And it's just, it's raining and wet and windy. And you just think, oh, can we have some? That's why you've got the sports that you cling to in the winter months. It's, you know, it's football, you know, soccer and rugby and racing, and then in the summer it's tennis and it's golf and it's athletics and it's these sports. So we're big sports fans. I think we're probably better at watching sport than we are at playing it, and the reason for that is just because we don't. I still go out to Australia. I say I go out to Australia, obviously not now and probably not next year, but I go out to Australia quite often. And there, everybody is doing sport from 5 a.m. because it's bright and it's light and it's sunny and it's warm. And that creates people who play sport. Now, we want to play sport in Scotland. And I still prefer playing sport to talking about it or watching it. But my God, it's difficult in Scotland. Honestly, golf was my thing growing up. And I used to try and practice. I wanted to be a golf pro. And then throughout the winter months, you would honestly have 50-mile-an-hour winds every single day in the driving rain and it was dark. And you just could not practice. So I thought, you know, I envied the children in the United States, you know, in Florida or Arizona or California with the endless sunshine and just the ability to say, right, I'm going to practice from this time to this time today because I know I can because the weather's going to be good. Whereas in Scotland, you had a weather window opening of about 5 minutes in January. And you thought, right, I've got to do all my practice in this 5 minutes. My God, I'm going to make it pay. But it's so, yeah. So we to your original question, we take what joy we can when we can. So we really get into the sport.
That makes perfect sense to me. I do remember, the winter must be something, because I recall needing the full-on sweater, and I'm not sure if we hit 60 Fahrenheit in a June afternoon.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. In Scotland, you know, you think of Scotland and it's so far north compared to the United States of America, you think, well, it must be freezing. But of course, it sits at the end of the Gulf Stream. So all we do is get battered by wind. We're a rock on the edge of the Atlantic, and we get battered by wind and rain. And all the seasons kind of melt into one another. So you can get, I've stood on the top of Scottish mountains in June with the snow and the sleet coming in, and you know, it'll be the same in the winter. So sometimes, you know, I long for the continental climate where you get really cold, sharp, clear winters and then hot summers, and all the seasons are so distinct. Even autumn or fall and spring, they're distinct, whereas in Scotland it's just, we have four seasons. It's grey, 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 and also grey. So it's I don't know, I'm not painting a good picture of Scotland. When the weather is good in Scotland, and it quite often is, there is no more beautiful country in the world, but we are a bit cursed by the weather as we sit there, as I said, on the edge of the Atlantic.
One more Scottish question, and then we're going to move on to the canines. So I have a picture I've always had of my grandfather. We don't have Scottish heritage; we have Irish heritage, but we did have Irish relatives who moved to Scotland, to Musselburgh.
Hang on a minute. Okay, I'll come to Musselburgh in a minute, because that's a fascinating place. But surely your surname, is that not Fornatale? Are you not Italian?
Well, see, we come from what used to be known as a mixed marriage in New York, Irish and Italian, the classic New York, the New York cocktail. So it's the Irish side and the Italian side. But the Irish side ended up identifying as Scottish. And I had this picture of my grandfather in the kilt and the full regalia when I made my first trip to Scotland in 1994. I made sure to get a matching photo. And the question that comes out of this is, do Scottish people get tired of Americans asking about kilts all the time?
A little bit, yes. So the kilt is funny. The kilt and tartan in particular only became sort of romanticized during the reign of Queen Victoria, because she and her German husband Albert, they were big Caledonia files. They had Balmoral, and he in particular was a big fan of the tartan. So the kilt, you know, in centuries past was the garb of clan chiefs and clan warriors. It was sort of plaid that was just wrapped around. But the kilt as we know it today, the sort of ceremonial kilt, that really became popular during the Victorian era, as so many things in Britain do have their roots back in the Victorian era. You know, when we talk about Christmas now, when we see Christmas, and therefore the Christmas that's been transplanted over to the United States, that all comes from Germany, and that came through Albert and his German heritage. Well, not his German heritage, he was German. And so that what we know as Christmas today is a German Christmas, but it all came from Queen Victoria and the Victorian era. Again, I'm straying slightly from the path you wanted me to go down here, Peter.
No, that's good. But that's good.
Anyway.
We're learning a lot here.
So... You know, we as youngsters wore kilts, but we were given kilts to wear for special occasions. We'd go to Sunday school wearing kilts. You wouldn't wear a kilt every day. A kilt was a thing for just special occasions. You'd wear it at a wedding. You'd wear it, you know, at a... I might even, when I came down to London, first of all, I was determined to show off my Scottishness, and I would wear a kilt, you know, to award ceremonies or whatever, as I applauded someone else who'd won an award up onto the stage and tried to look dignified and not at all upset. Anyway, but kilts, no, kilts are not. There might be one or two diehard Scottish people who will insist on wearing a kilt more often than. But really, it's all for the tourists.
Oh, that's so funny. I do appreciate them when I see them at Royal Ascot. That idea that you can wear your national dress, it's good stuff. All right, it's time to pivot and talk about your newfound fame. We've talked a bunch about 2020 and the weirdness of it already on the show, but undoubtedly there are some things that I'm going to say just never would have happened that are good things that have happened in the world this year as a result of these bizarre conditions we've been living under. And for me, One of those things is you using your broadcasting skills to comment on the quotidian activities of your pair of Labradors. Labradors get a lot of time on the show. Mugsy, the handicapping Labrador, as we know her, she's not in the room right now, but she's typically, you can hear her rattling her chain in the background or barking when we tip a horse that she likes. So the audience, my love of Labrador is well known.
20 seconds to go now. Olive closing in on victory in that coveted prize of being told she's a very good dog. One paw to control and a switch. Now Mabel sensing this might be a chance, still waiting, still believing. And you wonder what Olive is doing here. Only has to hold on. Going to the upright, though. High tariff with no opposable thumbs. High risk at this stage. And it's gone, and Mabel takes it. No mercy from the younger dog, who takes this victory just as time runs out. A famous win built on patience and sheer belief. For Olive, only thoughts of what might have been, but only herself to blame. She's given this one away, and that will hurt most of all. Bad dog.
I just want to get a little bit of background on how you came to be using your skills as an announcer to talk about Olive and Mabel at the food bowl in the park. And all
yeah,
that.
Well, exactly. I mean, it came about at the start of March, so I had done Scotland against France in the Six Nations. So Six Nations is the big rugby tournament of spring where you've got Scotland, England, Wales, Ireland, France, and Italy. And so I was getting ready for one of the final games on the final day. Which was going to be on Saturday the 14th of March. So on Friday the 13th, there we go, there's an omen. I was getting ready to go down to Cardiff where the match was going to be played in front of 70,000 fans. This was actually just after the Cheltenham Festival where he'd had, you know, say 150,000 fans. And already there was a lot of people saying, this shouldn't be happening. We've got the spread of this virus and Cheltenham should not be happening. Look at all these people in close proximity. So I think we kind of knew that Wales against Scotland and other matches were living on the edge. In fact, the other games on that final weekend had been cancelled. Wales against Scotland was the only one remaining. And then I was just getting in the car to drive down to Wales, all my prep done, ready to commentate the next day. And the text came through from the editor saying, no, look, don't bother, it's been called off. And then 2 minutes later, and it really was 2 minutes later, an email came in from Augusta saying, we've decided to postpone the Masters. And then the London Marathon went, and then within the next week or so, the Olympics had been postponed, hopefully not cancelled, postponed. Wimbledon, the Open Championship, and these are all events that I work at in the summer. So suddenly, you know, there was no work. And I'm a freelance broadcaster, as most people are working in broadcasting and sports broadcasting. We're freelancers. So I was looking at no work, and it was rather terrifying. But I had on that Friday, on the next day, I'd gone out and thought, well, I'm just going to, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to commentate on my dogs. I'm going to show how ridiculous this whole situation is, that I'm a sports broadcaster and all sports gone. So here I am, left with nothing but commentating on my dogs eating their breakfast. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Oh, that's great stuff. And for those who haven't seen the videos, this is a rabbit hole you're going to enjoy going down. And what's the best way for folks to get caught up if they haven't?
It really is a rabbit hole now. But there's so all the videos that I've made, or certainly all the ones that I consider good enough, are on my YouTube channel, and they're on a playlist, an Olive and Mabel playlist. So it's Mr. Andrew Cotter is my YouTube name. And they're all there, and they're sort of in that order. They go from the eating the breakfast one, what happened, and it's all sort of laid out in the book in slightly greater detail in the UK version of the book. The American version comes out today, if it's going out on Tuesday. It comes out today, the North American version, and they wanted all that condensed into the introduction, which I was quite happy to do. They wanted it to be more about the dogs. But the whole story of the viral videos was kind of fascinating, because as soon as I'd released that first one and it took off, and it's had, I don't know, about 11, 12 million views, if you take all the things together, it was astonishing the way it spread. But then, you know, within just a couple of days, people were saying, hey, I love this. When's the next video coming out? And my thinking was, I don't know. I hadn't what? A second one? So, and then the second one was the Game of Bones one, which was just Mabel waiting for Olive to make a mistake with the bone that she was holding and she would get it. And so I did that in the style of a more sort of slow-paced commentary, the build, as we talk about. And that one just went absolutely mad around the world. So that's at over 20 million views. And the fascinating thing for me was that recently, a guy who, I mean, and your listeners may well be very aware of him. I didn't know of him, but White House Deputy Chief of Staff, one of them, Dan Scavino Jr. And he had, all I can say is, pinched the video, cropped off any reference to me or any credit to me, and he had used it as an allegory for Trump against Biden. So this is seven months after, you know, the original video, which was just me and my two dogs having a bit of fun. And suddenly there is Mabel waiting while Olive, aka Joe Biden, is celebrating victory. And he's saying, yeah, we're just going to, and he presented it without so many explicit words as, don't over celebrate too soon. So Mabel is suddenly Trump. What's going on here? And she's waiting for the. And then James Woods, the actor, who I didn't realize is quite a diehard Republican, he retweeted it and basically was saying, yeah, this is it. Olive, aka Biden, is going to get his comeuppance. And so then I suddenly had lots of people from the American right starting to follow me and thinking that I had presented Olive and Mabel as this allegory for what was unfolding in the United States and the political scene there, whereas really it was just a couple of dogs being tools. So it was the whole thing was. But you know, at the start, it wasn't just, you know, recently it was Scavino and Woods. Then, but before that, you know, in the spring, it was Mark Hamill and Julianne Moore and Ryan Reynolds and you know, Richard Schiff and Bradley Whitford from the West Wing. So all these, you know, actors were stars in America were getting on board with Olive and Mabel, and the whole thing was just bizarre. But still, the requests kept coming, you know, of make more videos. So it just went on throughout the year, and I think the one which tickled people most was when I stopped doing the. I mean, people kept saying, I love it when you do the commentary on your dogs. But then the one which really was a sort of a nice shift for me, because I didn't want to be the parody commentator. Because, you know, Peter, I've got to go back and do commentary on serious events. I'm supposed to be doing the opening ceremony at the Olympics or Wimbledon finals or whatever. And if you're the guy who commentates on his dogs, you can't necessarily be taken too seriously when you're describing, you know, as I say, something on center court at Wimbledon or whatever it might be, at the Masters, whatever. So then when I moved it away from the commentary to do a Zoom meeting with my dogs, that was the most satisfying thing, because that really captured, I think, a moment, moments throughout this year that we've all been feeling just tied to Zoom meetings all the time.
Right, guys, thanks for joining us. Just keen to have a chat about where we are, the situation at the moment. I think you're both there. Olive, hi, thanks for joining us. Mabel, you are connected, but you need to start your video. It's down at the bottom of the screen, it's a camera. It looks like a biscuit. If you just nudge it with your nose, you should. There we are. You don't have to be so close if you want to move back a bit. All right, thanks. Right, so basically an update as to where we are. I can see you both look worried, but the good news from head office is that neither of you is going to be furloughed, but we have to try and repay that loyalty with some of our own. I know that's supposed to be a strength of yours. So what we're looking for, what management are looking for, are ideas. Sorry, Mabel. This is one of the things that we have to address, the lack of focus at times, because, there's the inappropriate stuff with Kevin the Doberman from accounts as well, but one thing at a time. So there are things that we have to try and improve on. Well, I'm uncomfortable with the chat as well, but Mabel, you switched off the camera again. Can you switch it back on? You switch the video? Right, there we are. Okay, the annual report. You've pretty much ruined the sofas. 913 squirrels chased, none caught, so not a good return. So again, things to... Sorry, Mabel, if you're going to do that, could you just switch off the video function again so we don't have to see it?
From then on, I just started doing little sketches with the dogs in everyday life, online dating or making flat pack furniture. So I've enjoyed the whole experience of it, but my goodness, it's been strange.
How have their lives changed, Olive and Mabel? Has the celebrity gone to their heads?
Yeah,
shown a sudden interest in politics? What's the story?
They're difficult. I mean, Olive wears a MAGA cap. No, she doesn't. She wouldn't do that. She wouldn't do that. I would tell her you're a bad, bad dog if she did that. So no, it's they get stopped on walks by people who genuinely say, "Is that Olive and Mabel?" I mean, I was up. I was up a hill in southwest Scotland. It's actually in the it's at the epilogue to the book. I didn't mention any of this in the book, but when I was up the Merrick, a hill in southwest Scotland, in September, 10 different people stopped me and said, you know, just by looking at them, I wasn't even shouting their names, just said, is that they look, is that Olive and Mabel? And then that's when I realized, you know, kind of how far this had gone into society as a whole, never mind the online world, which is actually quite a small fraction of, you know, because I found out that the videos were being passed around in WhatsApp groups and things like that. So people were just, you know, Olive and Mabel genuinely have become quite famous. They don't know what I look, I mean, I appear in a couple of videos, but it's mostly just my voice. So they don't know who I am. And, you know, my you know, recognition from my sports broadcasting was minimal. Again, people never see my face anyway. It's always just my voice getting things wrong in a sports commentary, so they don't know who I am. But by goodness, they know who Olive and Mabel are now, though.
Oh, that's great. You see, yeah, your fame is, it's all by proxy. So breeding, dog breeding, horse breeding, two, you know, very involved industries. Yeah. And one interesting thing about labs, British labs are very different than American labs. They're sort of typically described as more blocky and densely coated. The American labs typically a little bit taller and lankier.
And that's exactly, because that's because over here, well, it depends if you buy Labradors as from show lines or from working lines. So Olive and Mabel are from working lines, so they are slimmer, they're lighter, they're more sort of natural, whereas show Labradors have been bred to be chunky, and that's what we do, and that's what they do in equine breeding. It's the selective breeding. It's, right, what do we want here? We want enormous rear haunches for power, whatever. We can see that's okay, so we're going to you know, that's going to be the sire, that's going to be the dam, that's going to, okay, that's going to work perfectly. Let's create something like the mad Einstein geniuses we are. You know, and dog breeding, I find a little bit, I'm a little bit uncomfortable with it, because we decide, right, okay, we want to create something with tiny little legs and a short snout, and it'll have ears made of, I don't know, licorice or something. I don't know. So can we make that happen somehow? But we don't necessarily, you know, take into account what the health of the dog is subsequently going to be like. That's why you have Dachshunds have spine problems, and Cavalier King Charles Spaniels have all sorts of cranial problems. You know, the list goes on in terms of bloodhounds or whatever it might be. You know, we've created these dogs, bulldogs with breathing difficulties, because we have molded them as we, you know, sometimes for appearance, sometimes for work, sometimes for our own entertainment. It's just, it's nonsense. I like dogs to be healthy and to be dogs. They are wolves. They are, you know, you look at the wild dingoes of Australia, that's kind of your sort of archetypal template for a dog. And look at what we've created. And you look at a Chihuahua and a Great Dane and go, this is what? They're the same? Come on, this is, how have we done this? So I don't know. I'm a little bit, I love dogs, but I love dogs being healthy and being dogs. So I'm not a huge fan of the selective breeding that goes into making dogs as we want them to be.
I've heard it theorized, and I love this theory, that in many ways, Labradors more highly evolved than humans in terms of what their way of approaching life. What do you think about that notion?
I think more highly evolved, but in our centuries of evolution, we have created all sorts of things which create problems for ourselves in terms of our desires and our wants and our Machiavellian maneuverings to get things. Whereas Labradors haven't evolved massively beyond the fact that they just want food and they just want to be comfortable and they just want to sleep at times. So they haven't evolved beyond the basic needs, but the basic needs make them happy. So evolution causes a great deal of problems. If we could devolve somehow, if we could just go back, you know, 10,000 years, and we just wanted food, and we just wanted warmth, and we just wanted comfort, and we weren't interested in status and political maneuverings or whatever it might be. You know, a simpler creature is sometimes a much happier creature than the sort of higher creatures that we are.
Devolution is the new evolution.
Yeah, perhaps. Exactly. Let's head backwards. Let's head back to the swamp. on a swamp. I'm not allowed to say the swamp anymore. Has the swamp been drained? How is the draining of the swamp going over there?
That's a whole other tangent we could go down.
Yeah. Or not. Let's not do that.
Yeah, we'll stay away from that. We'll stay in the terra firma of pet ownership. Yeah. Because this is something, I mean, pets, not, you know, the Labradors, whatever your pets are, now more than ever. They've provided so much comfort during the year 2020. The stories about pet adoption, especially going through the roof in the United States. What would your advice be, though, for those interested in adopting Labradors specifically?
Well, go into it with your eyes open as well. Don't go into it thinking, I'm going to get one of those creatures that are in the, you know, Disney cartoons with the big eyes, and you know, it'll be fun. They'll be great, and because they're animals that still demand a lot of care and a lot of attention, a lot of walking, a lot of feeding, a lot of our time and a lot of discipline. If you want to make your lives, you know, you'll get people who don't realize everything that's involved in owning a dog beyond the, because I, just like you said there, in America and certainly in the UK, people have been getting dogs left, right and center because they're looking for that companionship. They're looking for that connection, that bit of normality, that soothing bit of therapy that dogs offer in this horrible year. But you cannot forget that dogs demand a huge amount of work and involvement from their owners. And, you know, for all the, as I said, the sort of cartoonish niceness that dogs present, they do need a lot of investment in our time. And if you've got that time and you've got the energy to do that, but it's a little bit like, you know, when you were young, did you want a dog? I wanted a dog when I was young. And, you know, again, this is in the book, but I didn't want to own a dog and to have all that responsibility. I just wanted the dog to be playing with and to be stroking occasionally, and then to just sort of push it away. It's the equivalent of being, I wanted to be the uncle or the, you know, of children that can just sort of, you know, play with them and then go, yeah, well, go back to your parents now because I can't be bothered doing all the hard work of, you know, you're feeding you and whatever it might be. So I'm fun uncle that turns up and just does all the fun stuff without all the responsibility. So there's a lot that goes into owning a dog, and you've really got to be committed to it.
That doesn't work with dogs. That's right. It is a commitment, and labs definitely present their own set of challenges. One of my favorite lists in the book, you talk about how Labradors in some circles are known for wanting human approval, and you can train them based on the doling out of approval. But you came up with your own hierarchy of Labrador needs that was very accurate in my experience.
Yeah, so we were told as well, and a lot of people are told that, you know, dogs will do anything for, give them praise. You know, when they come back to you, give them praise and go, oh, you're a good dog. Well done. Oh, you're a great dog. Thank you very much for coming back to me. You don't have to say that because they don't understand what you're saying. But it's all about the tone, and it's all about the encouragement, and just fantastic. Well done for coming back. Again, I'm speaking to my dogs. This is what I do. But anyway, they love that, and they love being told they're a good dog. And they do. They do love that. But Labradors, so I think in the book, it's pretty much so. So Labrador's hierarchy of what they like as a reward is number one, food. Number two, food. Number three, we get to food. Four is also food. And five, maybe five, but I'm not sure it even sneaks into the top 10 as human approval, because there will be nine instances of food that will sneak ahead of it, because it's just all Labradors. It is all about food. Every single moment of every single day. It's, you know, if, even when they're sleeping, you know, and you see them dreaming, you think, oh, is he dreaming about chasing a rabbit? No, he's thinking about a cake. That's what he's thinking about. He's thinking about bacon. That's what he's thinking about. He's not thinking about chasing a rabbit. He's thinking about chasing a rabbit, which looks like a giant steak, maybe, but he's not. Anyway, so yeah, they are eating machines. And yeah, they're just never happier than when they're eating. And then they're sad that it's over in about 2.3 seconds.
I have thought that it is there's definitely a causal connection between their desire to eat and their trainability, the fact that they could do all of these amazing things as service dogs, etc. If they didn't have this insatiable desire, maybe they wouldn't be able to do all the amazing things.
Well, yeah, exactly. And you'll see your working spaniels who are, you know, quite often they're used as explosive detection dogs, and they'll do it for the reward of a tennis ball. And actually, my dogs love a tennis ball as well. But if you held out a tennis ball and a biscuit and said, oh, which one of these would you prefer? Then they wouldn't even see the tennis ball. It would be invisible to them. So they'd eat the biscuit and some of your fingers. And then once that was over and they had been checking the bleeding stumps on your hand for any biscuit residue, then after about 5 minutes of hunting for any more biscuits, then they might say, oh, God, there was a tennis ball there all the time. Oh, yeah, I'll have that now. Thank you. But so it's all about, yeah. I do love it when you see, you know, these dogs at airports and somebody maybe coming in from a flight in some, I don't know, nefarious country where there is known to be a drug problem. So and they're checking the people coming off this flight and the dog just goes and sits down next to somebody and they found drugs in a suitcase or whatever it might be. And the dog, I love the fact that the dog has no idea what the consequences are for this person who's going off for 20 years in jail. And the dog is just going, oh, I got the tennis ball, nailed it. And so the dog's just running around wagging its tail as this person's taken off in tears knowing that their life is over. And the dog's running around with a slobbery tennis ball going, this is a good day.
I have a couple of more for you. I swear I'll let you get on with your evening at some point, but I'm having too much fun. One of the things about the book that surprised me is I feel like almost as much as it is about Olive and Mabel and your life experience, it's a book about, well, what we call hiking.
Yeah.
You know, hill walking, whatever you want to call it.
The line's blurred. It's between mountaineering, yes, and hiking and hill walking. I think we could use all those expressions. But that's where I spend most of my time. Well, not most of my time. In normal life, you know, I live in the northwest of England now. So it's still, to get to the mountains that I adore in Scotland, it's, you know, a good four-hour, five-hour drive or whatever. But, you know, whenever I can, especially in the winter, I get out into the mountains quite often with Olive and Mabel if I'm not doing something that involves, you know, climbing, which they cannot quite yet do, climbing up an ice wall. I mean, God knows I've tried with them. You know, if you put a biscuit at the top of an 80-degree ice wall, then they might get up there, such as their desire for that biscuit. But I wouldn't want to put them through that. So, you know, I go out there with them because it is the greatest joy in my life, being out in the mountains with the dogs, and it's an escape from everything. And that's kind of what the book was to me. When I was writing it, I was thinking, how do you translate the audio visual success of, you know, of the videos into book form? And how can I write a book about my dogs? And people have said, what's the book about? And they're kind of saying, I can hear it in the tone, they're kind of going, this is going to be crap, Andrew, isn't it? And I say, and the satisfaction is from some of the reviews coming in saying, you know, I enjoyed the videos, but I wasn't sure I was going to enjoy the book, but I really have. And it's because you end up writing, it's just observations on dog ownership and a sort of memoir, but it's an escape into the world of dogs and an escape into the mountains. And we all kind of need an escape at the moment. And then you're writing about dogs and you realize that you're writing about life, you know, as a whole, because dogs are there with you. If you're a dog owner and a dog lover, those dogs are with you for all aspects of your life. So it's kind of, you kind of end up writing about life in general, because that's where you'll find dogs in all aspects of your life. But the mountains are just that for me, a total escape from everything else that's going on in the world.
Many great stories about hiking with the dogs in the book. Do you have a favorite one that you might want to share with the listeners today?
A favorite, the thing is, when I talk about the mountains, it's not necessarily funny. And I would like to think that the book is largely quite funny, but when I'm out in the mountains with the dogs, it's, you know, I'm not a religious person at all, but it gets as close to a sort of spiritual experience for me as it can be. And there was one climb which I did, which is detailed in just one chapter. It was just the longest day. It was pretty much this time of year. Well, it was kind of the 14th of December 2 years ago. So it was just about the shortest day of the year where I decided to take on, because that weather window, that tiny weather window in Scotland had opened. There was good snow conditions and sun was forecast. And I thought, right, I'm getting out there. And I went up to the Cairngorms, which is sort of midway up, sort of two-thirds of the way up Scotland, and that's where the big mountains are, the big rounded mountains. And you just disappear off into there, and there is nothing except for you and whoever you take with you, and on this occasion it was Olive and Mabel, and they're putting their total trust in you. And that's you feel that connection with your, when you're out in the mountains with the dogs, that they are just following you faithfully, because that's what they do. And they look to you and they say, right, this is a bit odd and I'm a little bit chilly, but this guy, okay, I trust this guy. So we went and did Bray Riach and Carncharl and Scorn Loch and Uin. These are all Gaelic names, which will mean very little, but they're big mountains. They're all in the top five in terms of height in Scotland. And it was snowy. And it was just, we started in the dark and we finished with 2 hours in the dark. And the whole day was just an utter joy. It was a total, as I say, total escape. And it was just me and my two dogs and the wild and the wilderness and the open mountains. And so it's not the funniest chapter in the book, although there is something about Queen Victoria that does make me laugh in it. But it was just the most beautiful day, and one that I'll remember, you know, until, and hopefully until my dying day.
That's great. I have one more sporting question for you, because you mentioned, you refer to it as a sporting credo, which I think is a good description. And this is something I've heard for years in English sporting culture, but it applies to horse racing in the USA. And these are terms that get bandied about a lot in USA horse racing coverage: form and class. And the expression is form is temporary, class is permanent. I was just curious to get your thoughts on what that really means.
Well, I think it means that you see it quite a lot in golf. There's no other sport that really has the highs and lows of form as golf, because it can seem to just blow in the wind your form, and you don't know why, but you get that confidence. And there are great players who have, you know, disappeared in terms of form. David Duval and Ian Baker Finch, you know, Open champions, and then they just fell off the edge of the cliff and disappeared in terms of form, and it had gone, whether it's motivation or confidence or whatever. So it means that form is the thing which rises and falls and disappears one day and comes back the next, and you can never quite tell when it's going to be with you, whether it's that confidence, that intangible thing that makes, you know, brilliant players who have all the ingredients to be brilliant players, what's the one missing thing? And it's usually confidence. And confidence either creates that run of good form, or confidence comes about because you have that form. But class is permanent. Class means you have that ability, but it's just got to suddenly be married to the form, because the form will rise and fall, but the class is always there. So good players, good sports people will always have a chance of coming back to the very top because they have that class, but they've got to have the form as well.
I've thought of class in that context as the level at which you were born to compete.
Exactly. Exactly. It classes your sort of natural ability. And by natural ability, I mean your natural talent, but also your work ethic and your drive. You've got all the ingredients. Those are the things which come together to make the great sports people. You can have somebody with all the natural ability in the world, but if they don't work hard, they're not going to make it to the top. If they don't have the confidence, they're not going to make it to the top. So that all makes the class, but the form can disappear for whatever reason. But if you've got the class, it should hopefully come back again.
And the specifics are obviously different, but the applications to horse racing should be obvious, just in terms of class and form and the way that they interact.
I think people don't, well, I'm sure they do realize, but some people might not realize just how hard all the top sports people work. I mean, it's ridiculous. And I think one of the ingredients that I've been talking about there that goes into making a top sports person is a little bit of an obsession with their craft, because you can't stand there and hit 2,000 golf balls a day without thinking, you've got to be a little bit almost OCD. Johnny Wilkinson, David Beckham, these are people who have openly talked about the fact that they are a little bit OCD in terms of everything has to be just right. You look at Rafa Nadal and the things he does on a tennis court in terms of his drink bottles have got to be facing out. He won't step in any lines in the court. He's got these superstitions and these foibles and these sort of almost mental weaknesses, but they're part of his obsession to detail and just the way he does things. And sports people, to get to the level, to get to the very top in a sport, you have to be a little bit odd. You have to be a little bit unhinged to want to do that thing over and over and over again without any particular promise, any guarantee that you're going to get there. You know, you look at sports like, and racing, I'm sure the depth in racing is pretty strong as well, but you look at football, I mean, soccer, or golf, or tennis. You can be a brilliant tennis player, or golfer, or footballer, you know, at your town level, your county level, your national level, but you're still a long way short of the very top of the pyramid. So it's there's no guarantee that you're going to get there. So to put in all the hours that it takes to get to the top of a sport, you just have to be a little bit weird, don't you? I mean, to do that one repetitive action over and over and over again, just with a desire to perfect it or to get as good at it as you possibly can. You know, that's why a lot of sports people don't make tremendously interesting interviewees, because they've done this one thing over and over again throughout their life. So why should we expect them to be rounded individuals? They're barking mad.
That's great. I brought this up thinking of horses, but as the more you talk about it, the more I realize the better application for my audience is probably thinking of it as horse players or punters.
Yeah.
It's really pretty similar ideas, I think. The book is Olive, Mabel, and Me, Life and Adventures with Two Very Good Dogs, on sale in the USA as of today. Get it wherever books are sold. It is fantastic. Great gift for the dog lover in your life and a great read as well. Andrew Cotter, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Peter. Cats might not like the book. That's all I'll say. So, but if you're a cat lover, you might still like the book. So I'm not ruling out anybody, but I don't think too many cats will buy the book. Thank you, Peter. Cheers. I've enjoyed it.
Cheers. Next up, very happy to be joined once again by the woman we affectionately call, I don't know how else you'd call it. I mean, it's an affectionate term. The first lady of the In the Money Players podcast, the In the Money Media Network even, Kim Ware from the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. Kim, how are things?
Oh, all is well here, Pete. It's nice to be back on this like super Saratoga dreary afternoon. It brightens my day to hear your voice and to get that wonderful blush causing.
Well, we have you here for a couple of reasons today, not least of which is to get our sort of state of the partnership address. This is our second year being ambassadors, JK and myself, for the TRF, and obviously you're the founding partner on the whole podcast. Just wanted to get the annual update, let people know, how are we doing? How did the In the Money family do in 2020?
Oh my gosh. You all have absolutely smashed the goal, Pete. You and JK as amazing ambassadors leading the herd of the In the Money Players podcast community. You have, by the end of the year, you will have absolutely crushed a goal of $20,000 for the horses of the TRF. That is amazing. That is an amazing accomplishment. And I cannot possibly express the gratitude we have for you and the fact that it's come from so many amazing individuals across the country and across the world, actually. You've got folks from Canada who've joined in the End the Money movement, and it's just extraordinary. And it's blown the minds of all of my colleagues and the board of the TRF, and just shows. It shows what I love to say most of all. You can use my funny blush-causing epithet, and I will always say that you guys prove that the horse players have the horses in their hearts. You know, you just do. So I just cannot say enough. It's been so much fun, which is also a plus. We've had a lot of fun doing it together, online, in person, all around town. But at the end of the day, we have made it meaningful contribution to the care of the horses in the TRF herd. So my thanks.
That's fantastic to hear. It makes me very, very happy. And we appreciate that so much. But of course, like I always joke when guests come on the show and do a great job, and I always say, well, you know, we're going to have you back soon because no good deed goes unpunished. So it is for us and the listeners. This isn't, it's great. It's always good to take that moment and say, hey, we've done a good job this year, but there's more work to do. And that's part of what I want to talk to you about as well here today, Kim, starting with the fact that today you were describing Monday afternoon here in Saratoga. The show will be dropping on Tuesday, and it's not just any Tuesday, it's Giving Tuesday. And I know that as you did last year, you've got some special initiatives related to that that I want listeners to know about, because maybe you gave earlier in the year and have had a couple of good weeks of wagering success and have some more to give, or you know, maybe it's just that time to do some giving in December. I know a lot of people have picked up on the Giving Tuesday vibes, and we want them to be thinking about the TRF. So what do you have planned for Giving Tuesday this year?
Yes, this is, as I was reflecting on earlier today, this is one of the things that makes us feel a little more normal about a year that hasn't been obviously terribly normal. And that's that this is an extraordinary time of year. It is the giving time of year. We've all given thanks over Thanksgiving, and now we're moving into the giving of the holiday spirit. So with Giving Tuesday, the TRF fully leans into this global movement of inspiring many, many, many people to give really moderate, modest gifts. The goal is together we can do a lot if we all do a little. And so the spirit of Giving Tuesday really is that. And what we do, each charity does their own thing. What we have really focused on at the TRF is to create one goal that is extremely tangible, very, very clear and understandable for all of our supporters and donors and friends. And so this year, our theme for tomorrow, for Giving Tuesday, which is the day that most folks will be listening to this, is the hoof makes the horse. That is our theme for Giving Tuesday 2020. Kind of a play on the suit makes the man, but the hoof makes the horse, because these are critical ingredients to that horse's health and well-being. It's having those four hooves upon which they stand more than 20 hours a day, some of them even longer than that. And when one hoof fails, the health of the animal fails. And so our daily work, our annual work, and the work that is supported by the In the Money great generous gift is that we take care of these creatures, and we take care of them from nose, tail to hoof, you could sort of say it that way. So the Farrier Fund is what these dollars will be raised tomorrow. Our goal is $15,000 in one day. It would be each year. It is our single largest day of giving of the whole year. And those dollars are the equivalent of 3 months of our Farrier Fund. So that's what it takes us to keep all those hooves across the country, across our herd, healthy and well-trimmed and in good shape, so that they will support those horses every day, 365. So it's an ambitious goal. It is our most ambitious goal to date for a single Giving Tuesday campaign. But we've been very encouraged and very grateful to the support we've seen for these kind of campaigns. And the thing for your audience, because coming back to the fact that your crew has done a great job this year, the one thing I'd love to ask of the amazing In the Money audience is not only to maybe think of, like, you know, tossing us a few dollars, $25, $30 tomorrow to show your support for this campaign. But if you've already given, honestly, without a doubt, the best thing I could ask of each of you to do is to tell one person who hasn't, a friend, a family member, a neighbor, a fellow handicapper, hey, this is Giving Tuesday. I believe in the TRF, and I think you might want to give them a little something today. It's a big day for them. That's my call to action. I don't know. What do you think about that, Pete?
I love that idea. Retweeting and sharing, probably the easiest way. I mean, I love the personal approach too, but if you're not comfortable, or if it's just easier to do this via social media, I'm sure you're going to have missives out there on Twitter, Facebook, etc. I'll share them all. That means folks in the Money Network extended family will be seeing them. And if they want to just stick their neck out a little bit, and regardless if they're going to be giving on this Giving Tuesday or not, if they can retweet and share this message, that would be fantastic. And I think, just, you mentioned that's an ambitious goal, the $15,000 a day for the Farrier Fund, helping these retired racehorses getting their 3 months worth of hoof care. Maybe just this once, instead of through the In the Money link, it makes sense to go through the general Giving Tuesday link that you're going to have, which I think the easiest way to find is to just go to the website, trfinc.org. And if you look there right on the homepage, there's going to be more information about the Farrier Fund. Now, obviously, all the social media is going to have the link right in it. So if you're talking about sharing, you know, you don't have to worry about that specific link. But for those who are just looking to give directly and help with this important goal, trfinc.org, the place to go. Does that sound about right?
That is exactly it. And I so appreciate that. I think that you know, your crew has really drunk the Kool-Aid that you and JK have made look so tasty, I guess. But now they can join you and become ambassadors themselves. And it is really fun, as much as just to watch the thermometer throughout the day. And that's what all of the charities are doing. This is not like a unique trick in our toolbox, but it is really fun as the day goes on to see that creeping across the page and seeing how, you know, many, many gifts together get us a really long way. And that's true for us all year long. And everyone, we try to make sure folks understand that, you know, $5 buys a bale of hay, and that's great. And $15 is a bag of grain. And, you know, these things, this is actually the nice thing about taking care of old racehorses, is that while they are, they need a lot, we can do it pretty efficiently. So your dollar goes a long way, and it is a really fun day for us. One other piece of this, which is for the really horsey, hands-on horsey folks who are listening to us today, is that we're also taking a page from the larger social media playbook, and that's this whole drop your beautiful fill in the blank. You know, you've seen them on the hashtag drop your beautiful horse head, drop your beautiful dog, drop your beautiful ex. So we're going to do drop your beautiful farrier. So we're asking all those folks out there in horse land to put on social media pictures of their farrier taking care of their horses. Cause you know, these are the front line for this work. And oh my gosh, as the sleet is coming down in Saratoga, the farriers are out there, and these are the days when they really, really are the heroes for us. So they're across the country, and they're not just taking care of our horses. Farriers are, you know, a backbone of the whole horse racing and horse industry. So tomorrow we're going to try to celebrate them as much as we're also trying to raise some dollars.
Unsung heroes, no doubt about it. And this is a great way to support them and support the great work you do. Now, before we get out of here, I want to talk about one more thing, because I know Giving Tuesday, part of its significance is the fact that it kicks off what are generally the most four important weeks of the year for any charity in December, where you're trying to make your annual goals and get all the ducks in a row. And I know that a key part of the TRF's December work is the hay drive. Should we tell folks about that for a minute?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there are always many, many ways to help. And boy, this is astonishing to me, quite frankly. I've been involved in nonprofits my whole life. I've always been a volunteer, and I've always been a fundraiser in some way, but not until, you know, joined the TRF have I done it professionally and come to really understand how much of our giving comes in over the next 30 days. It's kind of crazy, but it all has a lot to do with taxes and end of year and such things. So we appreciate that. And it really is tremendous. So one of the things that tends to be the most popular for us as we come into this last 4 weeks of the year are gifts towards our hay drive. It is our single largest campaign of the year because it is our single largest expense item in our budget. These horses eat a lot of hay. So we are looking this year, 2020, our goal for the hay drive is $120,000. Happily for us, with such gratitude, that is achievable thanks to a very generous matching gift that comes from a longtime supportive family of the TRF, and that is the Santulli Family Foundation. They have offered a dollar-for-dollar match for the first $60,000 that come in. And that's been rolling in. We're just over $47,000 right now on November 30th. We have a ways to go, but we're steaming right along, and each dollar that comes in will then be matched by another dollar. So we will get to our 120 when we hit the 60. So that is something that is just hugely important, especially it's not just important because it's a big number, but it's also important because this is the beginning of the hay season. The horses have been eating hay now for, you know, depending on where they live, between a month to 2 months at this time of year. And they will be on that hay up here, especially in New York and even in Kentucky, you know, well into April. So we have to buy a lot of hay, like now.
Gotcha.
The one other thing I thought I'd mention, I know we weren't trying to add more things, but something that we just sent I sent an email about last week, and I remember you and I talking about it this time last year, is just one more sort of thought, and this is not specific to the TRF. It's for all of the charities that your listeners care about, whether they be in racing or across their society in their world, is the gift of appreciated assets like stocks and mutual funds is just a throw it in there is something to think about this time of year as people are finishing up their giving. The gift of one share of appreciated stock is like perhaps the most powerful, easy, and effective way to give because it actually doesn't touch your bank account. And it's something we want to make sure folks keep in their minds. And I think as we get into next year, it's perhaps going to be even more important as we sort of settle into year two of this new reality. So just, you know, I put it out there as a little Google donation of a stock and you'll see all the benefits. You pay no capital gains, neither do we. We turn it into cash immediately and it's cash gift for us and it's a tax benefit to you.
Yeah, that's great. Now, folks who have questions about giving and on a larger scale and or tax benefits and stuff like that, I assume as part of your role, Kim, that's something they can reach out to you about. What's the best way for them to get a hold of you? But actually, before you answer that, just want to mention that if you're looking to have donations roll into that matching program for the hay drive, again, you can find all that information on the main site, trfinc.org. And in terms of those other donations and potential tax benefits, et cetera, what's the best way for folks to learn more about that?
Yeah, and I am, that just falls under my official hat, which is the Director of Major Gifts and Planned Giving. And so I would welcome people reaching out to me directly. And I'm mostly on email, which is kim@thoroughbredretirement.org. And I'm always happy to keep watching I watch our social media all the time. But best thing if you have a question about any of that is just to reach out to me directly, kim@thoroughbredretirement.org.
And I'll throw it out there if it's easier for people, if you want to put a message through the contact on the site, inthemoneypodcast.com, or a DM me at @loomsboldly, anything I can do to help get this stuff teed up. I know that's a hugely important part of the work that you do and the way that you keep these horses in hay and horseshoes and all that good stuff and the great work that you do over there at the TRF. Kim, we are out of time. But I want to thank you very much. Really appreciate having you on this Giving Tuesday. And I look forward to having you back on again soon, maybe with some announcements about some other fun and creative ways folks can support the TRF.
I cannot wait, Pete. And I just close with a huge thanks to you, my friend, to JK, and to all of your listeners. We are so grateful. And this has been fun.
That's going to do it for this edition of the show. I'd like to thank Andrew Cotter, Olive and Mabel. What a fun that was to get a chance to sit down with him, something I've been wanting to do since I first saw those videos. That was great chat. I really enjoyed it. And then, of course, Kim, we are always a joy to have on. We'll thank her as well. I'm going to thank our longtime partners, not just Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation, but also our friends at 10 Strike Racing, who've been with us through the beginning. Always root for those purple and black silks and really appreciate Marshall Graham and Clay Sanders and all that they have done for us. Most of all, though, I want to thank all of you, the listeners, for making these shows so much fun to do. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out inthemoneypodcast.com through the comments section there, or you can use contact on the website, or you can hit us up on Twitter. I'm @loomsboldly, JK, of course, @UTBigHair. I'm going to be sending out a note soon about voicemails. I wouldn't mind getting some more voicemails. Those are good episodes to have, especially in December as we wrap up the year. So be on the lookout for that. I don't have the number in front of me or I'd give it out here, but we'll be sending something around on social media to that effect as well. This show's been a production of In the Money Media. Our business manager is Drew Coatney. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kinchin. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos!